I'm Femi Okay. Thanks for watching the stream. Today on the stream, Sudan, life in limbo. Some of the best political analysis I've heard coming out of the current conflict in Sudan has come from a farmer. I really want you to listen to this. This is Kamal El Bashir.
In 4 years, the various leaders have been unable to do anything. And finally, we have this war. For 4 years, we've been told that the transition to civil authority would take just 1 year. Enough. In 4 years, they've not been able to form a government. You can't move the country forward. Do you move it backwards? At the end, you take us to war for your own personal interests, be it Hemeti, former Prime Minister Hamdok, Army Chief Burhan, or the devil. All of them are losers.
But the biggest losers of all, of course, civilians. Al Jazeera's Hiba Morgan has more from the city of Omdurman.
Since the start of the fighting in mid-April, aid has not been able to come into the capital for those who need it. And the needs are huge. Many people say that they can no longer afford to buy food because of the increase in prices. And many others say that they can no longer buy because they've not been able to access their bank accounts and have no cash on hand to be able to afford basic food commodities. Residential areas in the capital have also been cut off from power and water for more than a month.
We are going to be looking today at how the people of Sudan are faring while two warring generals fight around them in Khartoum and West Darfur State. How are they doing? Joining our conversation, we have Matt Nashet. He's a journalist who has reported widely on Sudan. He's in the Egyptian capital, Cairo. Dalia Abdulmonem is a Sudanese journalist and political analyst. She joins us from London. And Sibongani Kayola is a Sudan country director at Mercy Corps. She joins us from Port Sudan. Hello, everybody. Really great to have you here. Plus, our online audience who are also standing by to be in the comment section on YouTube. I want to play a thought here from Dr. Mohamed Aboubakar. And I'm just going to give you a warning because he's going to be talking about sexual violence. And what I want to know, Matt, Dalia, Sibongani, is the war on civilians? Because what Dr. Mohamed has to say makes me think that the generals are targeting civilians. Let's have a listen.
In recent weeks, there has been escalating recordings and reportings of sexual violence within the capital itself, as well as outside of Khartoum, mostly reported to be committed by the rapid support forces and confirmed most of these cases. And the biggest fear is that if that is left unchecked and if that these types of actions are left unchecked, this is only going to get worse.
So this doesn't look like it's crossfire. This looks like it's deliberately going for the people who are caught in the conflict. Matt, your thoughts? I want to talk to all of you about this. Matt, you start.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's both. You know, civilians are caught in the crossfire, and there certainly are civilians that are being targeted. I think both on an individual basis and on an organizational structural basis. So what we are seeing is questions already in regards to the chain of command, specifically as it relates to the rapid support forces. It doesn't appear that the leader of the rapid support forces has maybe full control over his forces, nor does he really seek to have full monopoly or control of his forces. Maybe that's another question as well. Mm. And so we're really seeing a free-for-all in terms of raiding homes on their part, in terms of using sexual violence and rape as weapons of war. And then we're also seeing the arbitrary nature of it from the rapid support forces in terms of detaining numerous young men on the street as well, based on no evidence, and then interrogating them, thinking that they could be spies for the army. Very briefly, on the army side, it appears to be actually more specifically targeted, at least within elements of the army or their supporters, perhaps some of their supporters from the old regime of Omar al-Bashir, in which we're seeing specific activists that are engaged service provision, journalists, for instance, medics within hospitals that He'd played a significant role in demonstrations against the former regime of Bashir, are now suddenly being targeted with death threats and right. calls and things of this nature from supporters of the army side. So we're seeing targeted violence. We're seeing violence on an arbitrary scale as well. And we're also seeing violence, I think, on a structural scale on both levels.
So Bongani, I can see you nodding. Articulate that nod for us, please.
To jump in here, I think when we look at the people who are left behind, these are people who were already vulnerable even before the start of this crisis. So you think of the people who were living in poverty. Those are the people who can't afford to leave the city. They're the ones who are left behind, the ones who may not have the connections or the resources to be able to leave and flee to a safer space. And their vulnerability is being compounded by everything that's continuing to happen in the city of Khartoum and elsewhere.
Oh, goodness me, Dahlia, go ahead.
I mean, I think if you look at our history in Sudan, what both the RSF and the army are doing is not new. I mean, if you just look recently, the recent conflict in Darfur or the Nuba Mountains, you know, they have precedents. This has happened before, but the difference is it's now come to the center. So now people are more aware of it, but this is not new. The cost of the war on civilians has never been the number one factor or the number one issue of concern for either side. So I'm not surprised that we're being hit from the ground in terms of the RSF looting and ransacking of homes and buildings and the sexual violations that have been going on. And we've been hit from the sky by the army, using its, air force to supposedly target the RSF, when in fact they're hitting the infrastructure of the capital, like hospitals. You know, there was a mosque in, I think Hiba Morgan actually reported on it. There was a mosque that was hit. Churches have been raided. So we as the civilians have had no respite since this conflict started. And the cost on us is the least concerned, I think, not just for the two generals, but also for the international community, simply because how long has it taken for any organization to actually step in and say we're sending in humanitarian aid or opening a safe passage for aid to come through? They had that chance when they were evacuating foreign nationals, but nothing came. And now it seems that there's also the huge risk of looting happening of this aid, because there is no control. The Jeddah agreement is basically worth the paper. It's not even worth the paper it was signed on, because neither side is complying with the Jeddah agreement.
So this is the
basic rules of war.
Exactly.
So neither side is complying with it. You know, the rapes are. I mean, I've been doing some research on the sexual violence and rape of girls, and it's staggering what is happening. It's underreported. Hospitals are understaffed. Hospitals are barely functioning. You know, food is running out. The UN released a report saying half the population of Sudan, some nearly 25 million, are in need of help, are in need of aid.
Dahlia, let me just bring in some more thoughts here. This is from Doctors Without Borders, because they absolutely back up what you are saying. And this is Jean Nicolas, who spoke to us a little bit earlier. Here he is.
The situation in Sudan is critical for all civilians in the countries, whether they are living in active conflict zone or in other parts of the country. The healthcare system is collapsing due to the fighting, due to the targeting of healthcare facilities and the looting of those facilities. The medical supply is desperately needed, and the population is also not accessing all the basic needs like drinking water or food.
So Bongani, over a month ago, we were saying, as an international community, people in Sudan, the Sudanese diaspora, were saying, we need your help. What have you seen that's different in the past month?
To jump in on what Dahlia said, the feeling of abandonment overwhelmingly occasioned by the evacuation of foreign staff from Khartoum and the feeling of abandonment by humanitarian organizations is 100% understandable. Sitting on that side, it's a very difficult decision for one to make. When the conflict started as an organization, we first and foremost paused our operations because we had to step back and balance the humanitarian imperative against the state safety and well-being of our staff, Sudanese and non-Sudanese. And once we were ready to get on the ground and start working, the current situation is unprecedented. So we're essentially going to be putting the lives of our staff at risk by asking them to provide this assistance that is so badly needed. And it's a very, very difficult situation to be in where we want to help, but by going in, we would be increasing the risk profile of all our staff. And this is not just international staff, but our Sudanese staff as well. Our own staff have been displaced. So we had an office of 40 staff in Khartoum, and over half of that number have left the city. And as a leader of an organization, it's very difficult for me to say to my team, oh, hey, get up and go and provide help when their own lives are at risk. Our facilities have been looted, and our own staff have lost everything as well. We haven't been able to pay salaries in some cases, and it's very difficult for our own team members as well. We do recognize the huge role that local initiatives have played in being at the forefront of assistance in many communities. And we do recognize that we need to support these efforts and not undermine them or overwhelm them. And so as we're thinking about responding, we're saying to ourselves, how do we continue to support these local initiatives and continue to provide the assistance that is much needed? But from our side, it's also a very, very difficult situation, given that there are no guarantees for the safety of humanitarian actors, which is something that should assist.
So does very difficult mean that you can't help? You've decided our security and our lives, and then the security and the lives of the people you're trying to help, do you just decide, you make that decision, we can't help right now?
We are helping. So collectively as an NGO community, we're currently active in 14 out of Sudan's 18 states, doing a range of things, healthcare, provision of food assistance, non-food items. So we are definitely on the ground, but the scale of the needs overwhelms the resources that we're able to get our hands on, again, because a lot of our facilities have been looted and we can't access the ones that are still standing.
Yes, Matt, go ahead.
Yeah, I think it's also quite refreshing of the need to or the plan to support local initiatives for two reasons. One, I think they already have the structures in place in order to assist people with the most fundamental needs. And they probably have, you know, the best, you know, understanding of the risks that are there and how to do that, because they're still present in that situation. But secondly, I think in terms of aid, you know, a decentralized approach should absolutely be the approach that's taken here. In the past, we've seen in Sudan more centralized approaches with aid. We've seen authorities intentionally try to divide and conquer, I guess, the aid community in a way between INGOs and local NGOs and UN agencies and their donors accordingly, sometimes putting them under different regulations. And the reason for that is essentially to try to consolidate aid efforts and then try to weaponize aid accordingly from communities that might live in enemy lines, or to closely dispatch military intel to follow other aid groups accordingly. So what we're seeing is that there's a lot at stake, and there's a lot at stake purely because we know that there's not a lot of humanitarian aid coming for Sudan, probably in compared to a number of other crises in the budget that's probably allocated to Ukraine in comparison and other crises in the world right now. And so with that little aid and with the country essentially, you know, the economy devastated, it would be entirely predictable for, you know, the authorities and particularly the army here, which would claim to be the imprinted legitimate institution compared to the RSF, to impose regulations once again in order to consolidate aid efforts and essentially cannibalize that aid. So I think the way around this is exactly what was mentioned. In order to decentralize aid and assist local, already local civil society community structures as much as possible, because I think that makes it significantly more difficult for aid efforts to be consolidated accordingly by the authorities.
Dahlia,
I also think there's several problems that are going to crop up in the near future. The rainy season is coming up, and the more people, there's more internally displaced people, the more that they will flood into other countries. And our surrounding neighbors already have their own problems. So you're looking at a humanitarian issue that could very easily engulf the whole Horn of Africa, so to speak, in a way, because we border Ethiopia, Egypt, Chad, Central African Republic, and South Sudan. And if it's already taken this long for aid or humanitarian assistance to come through, and I completely understand, the whole shock, it was a shock to everyone when the war erupted. But speed is of the essence. I mean, I think, in a way, taking your sweet time, as NGOs or as UN agencies, is to our detriment as Sudanese. And already we've all been hearing and seeing of the problems that Sudanese who have fled or managed to flee are facing, whether it's at the borders of Egypt or trying to get to Saudi or going to Chad. So my worry is within a month or 2 months, the situation is going to become even worse. Mm-hmm. And then what are we going to do? I mean, already as it is, as a Sudanese, I mean, my hands are tied. There's only so much I can do there was only so much I could do when I was in Sudan 3 weeks ago. And there's even less that I can do even being away from it. And so if I can't do that much and agencies, NGOs can't do that much, then what's going to happen next? And the picture that's forming in my head is a very grim and dire picture. And I'd hate to think what would happen if speed is not of the essence, it's not being pushed forward. I think there needs to be more noise being made. I think there needs to be more attention paid to this crisis, and it's frustrating to me as a Sudanese to see that where we are right now. And I still think the reaction of the international media, NGOs, UN is very slow, and it should have been sped up, because like Matt mentioned in regards to Ukraine, I think a week within the Ukraine war, aid was rushing in, processing was simplified,
Dahlia,
made quicker.
Something occurred to me. This is a headline that came out of The Guardian about Sudan. I'm just going to share it on my laptop. And this was from the same person who created an incredible scheme for Ukrainians to live in the UK. And he is saying, recreate UK homes for Ukraine scheme for Sudan refugees, urges one of the original plan's architects. So why can't we do exactly what we did for Ukrainians for refugees from Sudan who've been displaced? I want to share something with you. This is from one of my colleagues. He was reporting from Chad, which is where some people are fleeing to. And then Dahlia, somebody who is from Sudan and you're seeing these refugees, I really want you to tell me, what does this feel like when you see this? Let's have a look.
The border between Chad and Sudan is porous and wild. Lately, you can see smoke rising in the distance, faint and far away. But those living here say that is Al Janina, the capital of West Darfur, burning. The most active hotspot in Sudan's conflict, second only to Khartoum. Unarmed villagers caught up in violence, a consequence of the fight for control of a country. Refugees here say they escaped in the night, searching for days to find a safe crossing.
Not everybody came. We left the old people. They're still there. We can't go back to get them. We don't know what to do.
Dahlia, you had a conversation recently with friends about when can we go home? When are we going to go home? What was that conversation like? Tell us.
Pessimistic. Because we all do want to go back, but we don't know how or when, or if it's even possible to go back. I mean, Initially, I thought I'd be back within 3 months. Now I'm thinking maybe a year. Another friend told me, no, 2 to 3. So I don't know, because I don't see any silver lining in the horizon. I don't see any chance of either of these two men to, you know, put down their guns or put down their weapons and say, okay, let's talk, because that's not going to happen. And
is it often when we talk about Sudan, we talk about, oh, this transition to a process where civilians take over. Is that just abandoned? Is that just that's not realistic? The military will never allow Sudanese civilians to run their own country. Do you still have that?
Already you see...
Matt wants in on this as
no,
well.
No, please, Dahlia.
Yeah, Dahlia, go ahead.
I'm just saying already you can see there's a split within Sudanese, those who think we should support the army no matter what and forgetting whatever atrocities they've committed in the past and what they're committing right now, because they'd rather support the institution that is the Sudanese army than the paramilitary forces. But in my book, they're both equally the same. But at the same time, you can't have a country without an army. And I also say our politicians also failed us, just like so many other people have failed us as civilians, as Sudanese. So I don't know. I mean, I wish I had an answer and say, this is what it's going to be like, or this is how we should, this is the route that we should take. But I don't think anyone actually knows the answer to what's going to happen.
I have a number of questions from our audience who are watching right now. I want you to answer them very quickly. So, Bongani, help me with this one. What measures are in place for civilian contributions to help with the Sudan crisis? Quick suggestion.
The revised humanitarian response plan was launched yesterday. Mm-hmm. And a number of organizations working in Sudan, including Mercy Corps, have channels for individuals to make donations. There's also a number of locally organized initiatives. If you follow Matt and Dahlia on Twitter, you'll be able to see some locally organized initiatives that you can donate to.
Some guest collaboration here. Thank you for that. Mustafa asks, I'm going to give this one to you, Dahlia. Mustafa says, I'm very much worried about the availability of life-saving medications. One of my friend's mothers, after her heart surgery, is now in Omdurman. We spoke to this earlier about the complete breakdown of facilities that you would normally expect, utilities that you normally expect. What can you say to that viewer?
Get in touch with the local resistance committees in the three main areas of Khartoum, Bahri, Omdurman, and Khartoum. The resistance committees are working to try and get the needed medication to those who can't get out or can't get it themselves. It's the same thing in Darfur. Just get in touch with the local resistance committees. If you ask anyone, everyone, this is how Sudan works. You ask someone, someone else will help you and guide you. So that's my best advice. Don't risk it going to a hospital. Don't risk it trying to find medical attention. Just get help and they will come in and they will help as much as they can.
Matt, I noticed a tweet of yours, which was a really bold tweet, which was Sudan's security rivals have plunged the country into war. But how Sudan arrived at this point is a story in itself. I'm going to send people to the tweet because it's a long story. But how would you describe the story now in a sentence? Where are we now?
Oh, yeah. I mean, right now, I think we're in the worst possible but most predictable scenario that we could have arrived to. Maybe it wasn't predictable when we were in the heat of the moment, but hindsight is 20/20, as they say. And, the one thing that I wanted to add on to Dahlia's comments in regards to whether or not a civilian governance or transitional
Matt,
governance
you've
democracy.
You've got one sentence left in this entire show. Use it wisely. Go ahead.
Okay. I don't think for a lot of international partners, genuine civilian rule was truly on the table.
Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Dahlia. And thank you, Subongani. One sentence left in this particular episode of The Stream, but we will invite you back. This conversation is not over. Thanks for watching. I'll see you next time. Take care, everybody.